So this is a quick, I hope very quick, little lecture on Ta-Nehisi Coates, the first 30 or so pages of the book Between Me and the World. I'm not going to say a ton here. I mean, we're reading here a contemporary writer who, according to the jacket of the book, Toni Morrison tells me that she hears Ta-Nehisi Coates as the person whose voice replaces that of James Baldwin. We're going to read James Baldwin next. There's a lot of connection to James Baldwin, actually, because here Coates is writing a letter to his son in sort of the tradition. I'm sure this is a conscious reference in the tradition of this short essay we're going to read next week by Baldwin called My Dungeon Shook. And this notion about whiteness as something that is not exactly real in the world, but something that is believed in, that comes straight from James Baldwin. And this idea that race in general is not something real in the world, except insofar as real people are really treated in real ways because of the notion. The notion is a real entity in the world, but the thing that the notion points towards, if we wanted to get real fancy, we could say the word and the behaviors associated with it are real enough, but the referent of the word, the thing that in the world that it supposedly points at, right? So if I say cup, in Bulgarian, I could say chasa. Doesn't matter what word you use, that points at a thing in the world, right? I have a cup here on my desk right next to where I'm recording. In the case of race, however, there is a word, and really there are all kinds of words, and some of them are quasi and pseudoscientific, and a whole bunch of them are downright violent in themselves. These words point at a thing in the world that they call race, or that, you know, are supposedly specific races, and yet the claim here in both Baldwin and in Coates is that that thing doesn't exist out there in the world. You know, the way that Coates eventually puts it is that, you know, differences in texture of hair and color of skin are as old as humanity. But the idea that who people are and what they are and where they need to be placed in a social hierarchy should be based off of differences in hair, texture, and skin color, that's a much newer phenomenon. Race is invented much later than the differences that race nominally points towards. Race is an aspect of power, I think, is where all this goes. Anyway, so this is in the tradition of James Baldwin. I suggest, you know, with all these books, I really suggest if you want to know more about Ta-Nehisi Coates or this book, you know, get it. And if you can't, you know, afford it, tell me and I'll rip it off for you. I'll copy the whole thing if you really want it. So I just want to sort of list quickly to make sure that you're you know, catching a bunch of the stuff that's going on here. But I basically just want to name it, and then you know, you can have it in mind while you read or after you read, while you do your whatever kind of in-depth reading work. What is Coates doing in this portion? I think he's doing maybe two basic things. He is, one, criticizing notions of America, criticizing American ideals, most specifically. And then secondly, he is raising a set of very difficult, pushy, but he thinks super important questions. Now let's go back to this criticism thing. I want to say a word about criticism, and then I want to list off what I take to be the basic criticisms here. So what is criticism? You know, a critical attitude, if I were to define it, I would say a critical attitude is one which does not just accept the world at face value. In philosophical terms, we could say a critical attitude is an attitude that is not satisfied with appearances, but takes appearances, takes the face value that is presented to us in various circumstances, in various ways, and turns that into a question. This was the problem-posing educational model. And Frege, more broadly, we could call this a critical attitude. So the thing that I would like to guard against here is that those of you who have like a nationalist leaning and a conservative bent, you may well start to read these criticisms of American ideals and get defensive and be like, okay, like, so I've got myself like a problematic, radical, liberal, whatever the hell it is, professor. He's making me read this anti-American stuff. His intention, this is what the conservative talk show hosts would have you believe, my intention as a professor is to indoctrinate you to say nasty things about your country. I disagree with those conservative pundits, and I disagree with that general attitude. I don't want you to repeat anything I'm saying. I want you to take it as if it were a problem. Don't take what I say at face value. Don't believe me because I have some degree. Like, why in the hell should you believe that? Here's some middle-aged white guy telling you about a book written by a black guy about what it's like to live being a black person in the United States. You know, like my word is not the authoritative word here, nor is even Coates' word the authoritative word. We're both trying to give critical words which are supposed to operate like an itch. They're supposed to irritate you a little bit. When we get to Socrates, Socrates will say, you know, the role of the philosopher is to irritate the city, to irritate it so that it springs into action instead of being stuck in its lethargy. Socrates uses the term gadfly, you know, like a big horse fly that bites a horse and makes it jump. That's what a philosopher should be. That's what a critical voice is. So instead of thinking of criticism as sheer negativity, I would ask you to think about criticism as the raising of questions. And I think it's totally appropriate to ask questions about these most dominant ideals that we are surrounded by, especially given, and I think this is a fact, that as Coates says, there exists all around us an apparatus urging us to accept all this stuff. American exceptionalism, American innocence, white innocence, the idea that we have democracy, the idea that we are the greatest nation in the world, the idea that somehow because of Martin Luther King, civil rights, and as Coates very critically indicates, you know, the idea that good black people are the ones who let the dogs attack them, you know, and because that happened, we don't have racism anymore. And the American dream is like a real thing. And we should live in terms of this dream, which we can hope to achieve. And we will achieve one day if only we work hard. These are all aspects of dominant American ideology. And I would suggest that you will continue to be motivated by them and swayed by them. And because I agree with Coates, deluded by them. Unless you throw them into question. A thinking person never leaves anything unexamined. I mean, or if we do, once we realize that we've left it unexamined, then we have to turn around and examine it. Otherwise, we become unfree beings, motivated by principles and precepts which we did not choose, which somebody else chose, and which ultimately, if we look into them, are probably to the benefit of somebody other than us. Okay, so we started this class by asking questions about the classroom and about education. Like, this is supposed to be a concrete and practical inquiry. That means, on my reading, that we start where we are and we try and look around us and see what are the structures that are determining us. What are the structures physically? What are the rituals physically? What are the things that we do in a classroom which determine what can happen there? And then more broadly, what are the rituals and practices that we engage in our city? And also on the mental level, what are the assumptions which are guiding and constraining, you know, setting up a limited space of possible action for us? What are the ideological principles that we are all caused to believe? And then how are we caused to believe them? And is it in our benefit to believe them? So this is what Coates is doing. And he's doing it in a very, very specific voice, right? It's a passionate voice. It's a voice that cares. And his writing to his son is part of the production of that voice or the eliciting of that voice. Why does he care? Why is he engaged in this discourse, which is so critical, but also so questioning and so really vulnerable, you know, given that it comes back so frequently to the real destroyability of the body, and especially the black body, Why does he care so much? Because he's got a son, and his son is walking into the same world as him, or at least one that is very similar, and as far as he's concerned, still structured in the same way. Okay, so what are the ideals that are criticized here? And I'm not going to go in great depth into the criticism. Democracy. We are told that we live in the midst of a democracy, and because of the greatness of our democracy, this implies various things. It's one of the arguments about why we're the greatest country in the world, but it also is a sort of response to allegations of racism. Yeah, maybe there's a few bad apples here and there who say nasty things and use words that are hurtful to others, we are led to believe. But because we have this democratic system, really, it includes everybody. And if there are a few oversights, people who aren't quite included yet, well, that's just a matter of time. If you speak up and quote-unquote make your voice heard, that's going to fix everything. Oh, and by the way, what is the way in which you should make your voice heard? Coates talks about Black History Month and being shown these videos of Birmingham and Black civil rights marchers being attacked by dogs and police. And he takes this to be a lesson that is being taught by the schools. And the lesson is, if you need to change things, that can only be about making your voice heard. And the only way to truly protest and make your voice heard is to submit your body to be beaten by the state. It's like, that's not the lesson that Coates really wants to take from things, but he thinks that is a lesson that is given to us. These things are all folded up in these ideals. So we got to ask about democracy. Ask, what is democracy? Ask, have we got it? The idea of race. He claims this is an ideal of this nation. Of course, this is not something that most people would say. They would say, well, race doesn't matter here. That's what's so great about this country. And yet he says the country believes in race. It believes that it is real. And in believing that race is real and not just an aspect of behavior and not just an aspect of institutions and not just a feature of the organization of society with some folks on top and some folks on the bottom, believing that race really is real, that white people are a certain way and Asian people are another way and Latinx people are a third way and Black people are a fourth way and Arabs are a fifth way and so on, believing that is inseparable from racism. You can't believe in race and not be racist. And he says even more, actually, the production of race as a belief and an aspect of behaviors within a society is ultimately the product of racism. First, you have the violent attitude towards certain bodies. That violent attitude then produces a name for what those bodies are, which always includes those bodies being lesser, more backwards, more savage, more criminal, more drunk, more lazy, more stupid. Okay. So that's the critique, right? And we should talk about it. And then thirdly, there's the critique of the distinction, or maybe we should call this American exceptionalism. Key ideal number three, something that we are taught to believe in, that the United States is an exceptional nation, perhaps even, and not even perhaps, we're taught this straight out, the greatest nation in the world. Now, put aside that damn near every nation tells its population that it is part of the greatest nation of the world. But what's weird about the United States is that people seem to believe it. And if I asked you to give me reasons why you believe it, you would repeat the things that you were told in school about democracy and about opportunity and about the American dream. But what if that democracy is not real and that opportunity is not real, or at least it's heavily constrained? And what if the American dream is actually a complete fiction that people hide inside? This is his view, right? So the idea that we're supposed to believe is that America is exceptional. Coates thinks that the America that is represented in this exceptional picture is really white America, that it is democratic, that it is the greatest ever, and that outside of this nation, there are other forces which are really opposed to this greatness, and we can consider them as terrorists or despots, meaning like autocrats who rule without the consent of the governed, or barbarians, meaning backwards people who are opposed to progress and still live in some kind of savage state. Let me just point out that this fundamental distinction between civilization and the barbarians is as old as state structures. You can find it in ancient Greek writing and before. But it's also super core to colonial doctrines, especially in the 1800s forward. The English were always the civilized people. The Indians or the Chinese or the Africans or the Native Americans were always the barbarians. So colonial attitudes produce this fundamental distinction between the real people, the exceptional people, the progressive people, the greatest people, and everybody else who is supposed to submit immediately because of the greatness of the other. And if they don't submit, it's just going to be proof that they're a bunch of damn terrorists, despots, and barbarians. So they're screwed either way, right? They got to submit. It's nature for them to submit. But if they don't submit, that might be their nature too. And therefore, it is also nature for this great power, this great people, this progressive European, whatever it is, to kill them, take their land, and improve them. You know, like if you look at how this worked in the United States and Canada in the late 1800s through the middle of the 1900s, there's this program for Americanizing Indians, right? And the phrase that got used a lot as Native American kids were pulled into boarding schools where they were tortured, beaten, killed, beaten especially for speaking their own languages. The language that was used was that you should kill the Indian but save the man, right? If you turn this Indian into this civilized thing, well, you'll have done him a favor, as opposed to the recognition that what we're talking about here is, first of all, physical genocide, and then secondly, cultural genocide. So we're taught these various things, and we're taught them especially through the schools. So we have a critique here, again, of the schools. There's also a kind of systematic analysis of the relationship between the schools and the streets, right? He thinks they're both apparatuses of coercion. And, you know, people from, he's talking about black people, but probably we could talk more broadly about people from the working class and people, especially people from immigrant backgrounds. Y'all are always told you better stay in school because, you know, school is your only way to success. Coates gives this staggering figure where he says, of all the young black men who drop out of high school, 60% end up in prison. Whew. Wow. You know, that's a lot. So the idea is that either you stay in the school and it's going to conform you into exactly the submissive creature you need to be, the one who would never do anything against the system. And if you ever really wanted to transform it, you would do it by submitting to authority, not by challenging it. You stay in the schools and then you get to go to college and then you get to call yourself, you know, I don't know, what do you want to call yourself? Respectful Americans. Or you drop out of school and then you end up in the streets. Now, these are radically different things, right? Like, so the schools are state-sanctioned, and they're run with state money. But the streets are the opposite. They're state-targeted, right? So whoever does stuff out on the streets, you're going to be subject to the violence of other people on the streets. And that's like a question that is not answered here, but it's sort of raised, right? Why is there so much violence in black neighborhoods? Why is there so much violence in working-class neighborhoods? Why is there so much violence between people of color? And then, of course, what about the violence between the police forces and all these other people? And what about the weirdly innocent violence of white people, especially like white gentrifiers, who aren't doing the beatings, but they're calling them down? You know, like, what is up with this violent situation? Well, one way or the other, the schools and the streets basically operate to compel utter submission. And if you don't submit in the schools, ultimately you're going to be killed on the streets, or you're going to end up in prison. This is his harsh critique. Now, this brings me to the last ideal, the idea of the dream. Now, I've read the rest of the book, and I know that he's talking about more than the American dream. I think he is talking about the American dream super clearly, you know, and he lists it off. Like, what's the American dream? Perfect houses, nice lawns, you know, Memorial Day cookouts, tree houses, Cub Scouts. How does he say it? It smells like peppermint, but it tastes like strawberry shortcake. You know, this like kind of fictitious sweetness, this imagined happiness. So he is talking about the American dream, but as he goes on, he talks about dreams in the plural. And he thinks religion offers forms of dreams. There are probably multiple forms of dreams. And so when he refers to dreamers, he's not referring at all to people covered by the Dream Act. You might get a little confused there. That's not what he means. he's talking, when he talks about dreamers, he's talking about all the people who take solace in a in an imaginary happiness, an imaginary solution, an imaginary world. And he was taught not to do that, and he's trying to teach his son not to do that. He doesn't think it's befitting of a free man. Who's the model that he offers to his son? Malcolm X. What's so cool about Malcolm X? He's free. He seems to be somewhat free of fear, or at least he has not allowed his fear to get in the way of his speaking like a free person. Okay, so, I mean, this is the overall critique, right? Oh, and what's the idea about the American dream? Everybody's dreaming it, right? Everybody's thinking, oh, if I just work harder, I'm going to get to this place of security and peace and acceptedness, and we're all going to be alike in our appreciation of a white picket fence and of a good hard day's work and of a hamburger with our friends on the lawn. That's the dream, but it's not real, right? Why do we dream so hard? And you could broaden that, right? He means to broaden that. Why do we spend so much time in video games? Why do we spend so much money on silly little fashion items? Why do we work so hard to try and get a better paying job? Why are we dreaming so hard? Why do we want to believe in God so much? Why do we want to believe in heaven? Why are we dreaming so hard? The answer is because we're so afraid. Because we're so afraid. Now, he is talking very clearly from a black perspective, and so I'm limited in my ability to honestly speak to that experience, right? But from my perspective, as a person who is trying not to be so white, because, I mean, this is a nuanced sort of question, I'm sympathetic to that fear. I mean, I just like hooked up some links for you to see the references he makes to, like, you know, Eric Garner and Tamir Rice. And man, I see that stuff and I cry. Like I sob. That fear of being beaten, that fear of the state apparatus, that fear of being broken, that fear of being imprisoned, that fear of being tortured, that fear of being raped. That's, according to Coates, what drives the dreaming. And again, from my perspective, I believe that that fear extends much more broadly than the African-American population. I am certain that it exists quite broadly in the white folks that I grew up with. You know, like, people are afraid. They're not necessarily afraid in the same way of being attacked by the police. A lot of people are afraid of their neighbors. They're afraid of economic collapse. They're afraid of fictitious enemies. They're just plain afraid, and they're not sure why. What if America, you know, instead of being the greatest country in the world, is one of the most fearful countries in the world? This is harsh criticism, right? Now, so if that starts pissing you off because you're nationalistic, I would ask you to turn that into a question and just say, well, why does it piss me off? Why do I need to defend this nation? Because you don't live in the nation. You live in Los Angeles, right? You don't live with Americans. You live with the people in your building and on your block and the people at this school. Like, what is the need to identify as with this flag and with these ideas of treehouses and hot dogs and baseball? Why? Like, what's your investment? Why are you pissed off? Could it possibly be that the need to identify with these things, the need to believe in the greatness of this country, the need to believe in our innocence in a land that was taken from indigenous people, in a land that was based on murder and physical and cultural genocide, why are we so invested in believing in our own American innocence? Perhaps it's because we're so afraid. Okay, so I'm just going to list these off now. He also asks a set of questions, and then I also ask some questions that I think we can talk about. And I also give a bunch of, you know, I give a list of the things that Coates recommends. But I'll just start with the questions that he asks. He's like, okay, so the U.S. is supposedly a nation where the government is built by the people. It's a government of the people, and it's for the people. You know, and he does this in a sort of rhetorical fashion. He's like, yeah, let's say that Lincoln actually meant that. The question is not whether he meant it. The question is who counts as people. And then he asks a very technical question. His question is, what is the means by which the people acquired their names? How does it come about that at one or another point, people are more or less American, that some people are American and other ones aren't, that some people are the people and some people aren't the people? I was listening to like conservative talk radio today, 760 or something like that, because I like to know what they say. And I heard them talking about homeless people in Los Angeles, and the diagnosis was that everybody on the streets ought to be got off the streets. All the crazy ones ought to be put into mental institutions, and if we don't have enough, let's make more. All the criminals, and a bunch of them, according to these talk show hosts, are criminals, they ought to go into jail, and if we don't have enough room in jails, we ought to build more prisons. Hell yeah, they thought. And then lastly, there's a leftover group, they claim, people who just don't want to work. They're lazy. Well, they should go away. And then one of them suggests, or maybe they should be sent to the gas chamber. This is on the radio today. Today. Who gets to be the real people and who are disposable people? There really is a distinction. It really does operate, and it really does have a history, right? It really has a history. And this you know, brings me to Coates' attitude towards questioning, right? You can just cruise around, you know, like believing that you're against this stuff and that you're for some other stuff or whatever. But if you never look into how these power structures came about, how these dominant ideological systems came about and have been distributed, you're never going to be free of them. And neither will your children. Neither will your friends. Only if you begin subjecting things to scrutiny and not just asking a passing question and not just coming up with like a quick conspiratorial solution, that's all the white man's fault. Perhaps it is. But just to say that doesn't help you. To look into what that means helps you. And Coates and James Baldwin will tell you, even whiteness is a construction, right? It's an historical construction. And we should understand it as an historical construction, because then maybe we can start to understand how it works. Okay. Second question. How do I live free in this black body? Right? Now, that can't be my question, but it's his. It could be yours, or you can modify it in whatever way you see fit. But even the question, how do I live free? Now, that sounds like a libertarian question, and we know a bunch of the answers, right? It's like, oh, well, don't regulate the market, back off government, and get yourself like a flag with a snake on it and put it on your truck. Then you'll be living free, right? But he means this in a much deeper way. How do you live free in a circumstance where the schools are constraining you, where the media is constraining you, where the police will hold you down and kill you? And so he says, the value of this question is not in answering it. Perhaps this is the case across the board. The value in questions is not in answering them, ever. Because once you answer something, you think you're done. But you're never done. There's never an end to questions. This question, how does he live free in his black body? How does his son live free in his black body? Is unanswerable. Maybe it's not possible, but the question has a value. The question has a power. The question compels a person into an attitude that is as free as possible, and in its freedom recognizes the real structures that are around it. So it's honesty, you know, the kind of political pragmatism that Coates ultimately praises in Malcolm X involves or is related to this questioning attitude, right? And then his last question is like a meta question or a reflective question, where he says, and why even bother ask the question? Why bother? Well, because this is how we draw ourselves into consciousness. This is how we become more human. It doesn't mean getting more happy. I mean, a person who is happy on the basis of a delusion, perhaps, you know, those of us who are earnestly trying to understand, we can understand that their happiness is no good. It's not valuable. You know, a person who's so happy because, like, you know, Santa Claus rides with them in their car every day and loves them so much. Well, we shouldn't envy that happiness. We should feel sorry for the delusion, right? And then we should probably think in the background, this person who has now gone crazy and thinks Santa Claus rides with them in their car at all times, perhaps there were traumas and tensions and fears which drove them to prefer this fictitious reality to the real one. This person is a dreamer. But perhaps we should aspire not to be dreamers. Perhaps we should aspire to be conscious And probably meaning conscious, being conscious, means that we're going to have to put ourselves into awkward and difficult and maybe antagonistic relationships to the world that's around us. But this is being fully human for ourselves, for our own dignity, and for the better being of our children. Okay, I think that's it. You can check out my little PDF thing if you want to see all the positions that I think Coates takes, or that I just list him taking, and all the discussion questions that I set up for us. I think all of his recommendations could easily be transformed into questions, and a big part of this class is about transforming a statement into a question, right? So, like, you'll see, you know, one recommendation that Coates makes is, like, we should throw away all belief in magic. We should not believe in an afterlife. You know, he doesn't say we should. He says his parents taught him this, but I think he's advocating for a stance like this. And then over in my discussion questions, I ask something like, is it true that we should not believe in any kind of magic? Right? So all of these things are things for you to think about and for us to discuss.